Hello and welcome to CJ Evolution, the podcast dedicated to helping criminal justice professionals like you. Now here's your host, fellow CJ Evolutionary, Patrick Fitzgibbons.
Hello everybody, welcome back. Episode 190 of CJ Evolution. Pat Fitzgibbons here, host and creator of the show, whatever you were doing, wherever you were at. Thank you for spending a little bit of your valuable time with me. I sure do appreciate it. Special thanks to all the brave men and women out there working in the criminal justice field, working in a very dangerous, ever-changing environment. Thank you for what you do. You have much support, even though you don't hear it every day. You have tons of support out there. So keep doing what you are doing. I really have been lucky over the last year and a half to have a wide variety of guests. You all know, thought leaders, leaders, you know, from the private industry, from the public sector, obviously law enforcement, criminal justice. And I was really excited to have my next guest on. His name is Paul Derry. He was a career criminal, or used to be a career criminal, and his story is just riveting. It really is riveting. It's going to keep you on the edge of your seat. And we just scratched the surface. I want to have Paul Derry on the show again to talk about his experiences as a criminal and working as an informant with the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. So I hope you enjoy this next interview with Paul Derry. Hello, everybody. Welcome back. Very excited to have Paul Derry on the show. He was under the age of 18. He was a Royal Canadian Mounted Police informant, and the story is just amazing, and I wanted to bring Paul on. I know he's busy. He's turned his life around, but I'm glad he's here. Paul, welcome, sir.
Thanks so much for having me, Patrick.
Now, I gave a little snippet of your background. I didn't do any kind of due justice to you. Can you tell the audience a little bit more about yourself, sir?
A little bit about me. I guess I started off when I was 15 years old. I grew up in a military family, so I had a good, base to a value system to start off with. Mm-hmm. I understood community. I understood a lot of, the things that, military is kind of a policing, organization in itself, yeah. Right? So I grew up with good values. I just, at a young age, had a wild imagination. We didn't have internet. We had books. I happened to get into a book called The Outsiders. And
great book. Great book.
A little S.E. Hinton, back when we were kids. Had to read it from school, as a matter of fact, unfortunately for me. But my imagination went wild, with gang life. And then from there, I got into Italian mafia-type books and got fascinated with the crime world. And then just said, probably at that age, that I wanted to be a career criminal.
Yeah.
And that started me down this whole road.
Yeah, now I was going to ask you, Paul, and I'm glad you brought that up, because it sounded like I don't know your childhood, but it sounds like you had some good role models. You had some people in your life. That was going to be my next question. What was your childhood life? But it seems like it was just a normal childhood. You just kind of veered off course.
Yeah. I grew up on a military base. So I went to a military school. My dad was, an awesome guy. We in hockey, scouting, all of the typical normal stuff, just rebellious. I was a really shy kid. So I guess, I always laugh because I quit school in grade 7 and took off to go down this journey because I didn't want to join the military and I didn't want to speak in front of a class. Mm-hmm. And, I didn't want to join the military because I didn't want to get my hair cut. I didn't want to speak in front of a class because I was shy. My hair all fell out and now I speak for a living. It's kind of insane.
In that karma. Paul, what did your parents do when you took off? I mean, obviously, I'm assuming they tried to get you back. They tried to talk some sense into you.
You know what? Back then, this was probably 1979. Mm-hmm. Military school. The school counselor sent us to whatever. When I was rebelling, they sent us to try a number of things, and then they sent us to a psychologist, and they said, "Give him a bus ticket, $50 out west." And I thought, well, if you're willing to do that, screw you. I'll just get on the road and hitchhike. And I did. And away I went.
And any brothers or sisters?
Two brothers, both in the Navy.
Oh. Now, what was the first stuff you got into? What was the first criminal activity you got into, if you don't mind me asking?
It started off selling pot at school and, really just small stuff. I mean, obviously, everything that comes with pot in those days, sometimes I had to steal to get the money to buy the pot. And, mm-hmm. But then mainly into dealing, and I kind of stuck down that road for a while, and you can't go into the crime world and really stick to one crime, so I think it ran the gamut.
Yeah. Well, and I know in the intro I talked about you being a source for the RCMP when you were under the age of 18. How did that come about?
It was interesting. There was two RCMP officers, just patrol guys, and they pulled me over and asked me to tell them where my friend's plot was. And, at $15, $20 seemed like a lot of money. And I thought, sure, I'll tell you where his plot is. So I told them, and then I ran as quick as I could to his place and told him that the police are on the way. You better hide his stash. And that I just ratted him out. And so he hid the stash. We kept the pot, and I made $20. Now, that was the first and only time I did it. But I always like to tell that story to say that, that is one of the dangers of dealing with sources, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you never know if you're being played either.
Yeah. And I was going to... So what is the role? You talk a lot about you were informant for many years. What is the role of a police informant? I think some of us know, but for those people that might listen, what is the actual role?
I'm not sure how it plays out in the States, but here in Canada, we have a source who would would give information. An informant is somebody who would actually be coded and would go out typically looking for information and, selling it to, I like to laugh with my reporter friends lots that we have the same job. We're both rats. We just sell our information to different people.
I like that.
They don't always like that. But at the end of the day, I mean, that's what I did. I sold information to police.
So were mainly
the RCMP.
So were you in a situation where they said, all right, Paul, here's the deal. We're going to throw the book at you. You're going to go away for a long time unless you start working for us.
I never in my entire career, including the last operation where many think that I did, I never ever had to rat on somebody to get out of a charge. First of all, I did most of my crime by myself. And I was just never in that position. I don't know if I would or I wouldn't. I guess I probably would. I would do it for money. I guess I would do it for anything else.
Yeah. Now you talk
but
about
it just never came up. So,
what is the most dangerous? I'm sure there's many of them, but what one of the most dangerous situation you've ever been in?
I'd like to say the last operation against the Hells Angels, but I'm not really sure that would be it. There was many dangerous moments, I guess, because of the intensity of the gang that it was. That made it more dangerous, and it certainly had the feel of more danger. But I remember there was two escaped convicts from Nova Scotia. They escaped from a federal penitentiary, stolen a car, a bunch of guns they had acquired along their journey. And they showed up at the house I was staying at the time. And so I joined in with them and went with them. And this is back, of course, we didn't have cell phones, of course. So I was with them for, I would say, 2 weeks. And they were insistent they were going to kill a cop if the door got kicked in. Or so when we were in hotels, they had their, shotguns loaded beside the bed and just ready to kill. So I had to sneak out all the time and somehow call my handler and try to arrange for the right place to take these guys down. So I would say that was probably a lot more scary than in 2000 when there was a little more technology and there was cover teams, even though it was against the Hells Angels. That time stands out probably as, up there.
Now, was that the only MC that you work with? Motorcycle gang? Was that the only motorcycle club or gang you ever worked with, or were there any other clubs?
Mostly affiliates, public clubs of theirs. So I guess all leading to the same head, right?
Now, how big were the Hells Angels? I mean, this has been big up in Canada. I mean, they're huge in the United States. I mean, are they still big or what?
I think there's a little over 500 members across the country.
Now, you were in witness protection. You reluctantly entered in 2000. Now, I know this is going to sound like a stupid question. It probably is, but I'll ask you anyway. What is that like, being in WITSEC?
It is the best way to compare it. It's like being on parole for me. I'm guessing for my family, it's a little different. For me, it's like having a parole. I mean, I've had to, if you've worked as an informant, your life has been in danger. I had my first contract put out on me when I was probably 21. So I'm used to living with it, so I never really seen the necessity for it other than some of the benefits that come with it. Mm-hmm. There's a lot that comes with it that people just don't think of. Changing your name in general, like losing your father's name if you're a man, that can be a big deal if you have, you know, if you love your father and respect him and, you know, want to carry on his name, that's, you know, you're getting rid of your surname.
Sure.
Simple little things like that affect you.
Now, how did it affect your family? You had a family, correct?
Yes. It's affected my children. It's been long term now, so you know it's been 17 years. Mm-hmm. So they were 2 and 4. The first children I had, I have a few more now, but the two that were mostly affected back then, we never would have foreseen all of the things we would have to deal with back then. Mm-hmm. Simple things like having to explain to them why their name is different.
Sure,
because they remember.
Yeah,
you know, the 4-year-old especially. You know, they remember, they have the flashbacks and they remember certain things. And then as time goes on, you know, all of a sudden, like there's been a couple incidents where we've had to, you know, relocate again. So, you know, how do you explain to, you know, a 13-year-old who's, you know, at that stage where he's got all these friends or she's got all these friends and all these police officers are taking you away and leaving all your stuff behind and in a quick, you know, midnight move type thing.
Yeah. And you talked about your contract you had on your life. By the Hells Angels.
Yes.
That was, how did that come about, Paul?
The first one I had, it was on by the Bacchus Club, which is an affiliate club of the Hells Angels. Mm-hmm. That was in 91, I believe. And that was from an operation I did, a drug operation. But the one that entered, got me into the witness protection program was after a murder of Sean Simmons in Halifax, which is still going before the court 17 years later with appeals and such. That one was an operation that went bad, you know, partially on my part and partially on the part of others involved.
Jeez. Now you do a lot of work, you know, you talk a lot about drug trafficking and human trafficking. I mean, I'm assuming you were exposed to human trafficking when you were, you know, in that life, correct?
Plenty, yes.
How bad? I mean, is I don't think people realize what a big problem human trafficking. I mean, drugs are a problem too, obviously, but human trafficking is huge now, and it doesn't get that much attention. I don't think.
I think it gets a lot of superficial attention.
Yeah.
You know, I think it gets a lot of, you know, a lot of the headlines. I mean, you could probably go on social media any day of the week and find lots of symposiums and, you know, different things that are using the human trafficking title. But I think if you get right down into it, no, I don't think, you know, we see report after report. I mentioned this not too long ago on an interview. I worked in the native population in Regina, Saskatchewan, and you know, there was girls as young as 11 years old with who I was working with at the time. They had taken a girl off that was 9 years old.
Jeez.
But there was, you know, the youngest I seen was 11, and they're already hardened by 12, 14, and they're being trafficked in and amongst, you know, this culture, and the Hells Angels are no different. OMGs are no different. They're they're trafficking women all over the place too, and transferring them from club to club. And it would be nothing for me to get a call on a Wednesday night or Thursday night after church, or when somebody's keeping watch at the clubhouse, and say, you know, can you send me over a couple of girls? Do you know anybody? Or, you know, can you contact so and so? So, I mean, they're a commodity in that world too.
I mean, you were talking about the Hells Angels. I mean, I don't know if you ever seen the show Sons of Anarchy.
No, I haven't.
Well, it's kind of. Oh, go ahead.
I know the show. I have a real because of a Hells Angel playing in it. I just never really wanted to support them in any way. But
true, I mean, I could see that. But I was going to ask you if you had seen it. I mean, if that was an accurate description, because this show was on Netflix. So there was like 7 or 8 seasons, and it depicted the life of a MC out in California, and I always wondered if that was an accurate description. I mean, it was a violent show, I mean, which, you know, you've seen throughout your life, much violence, but I always wanted to know if that was an accurate description, because they were into drugs, they were into guns, you know, trafficking and all that stuff, so...
I would say that any show that we would see on television is an accurate picture of street bikers. Mm-hmm. The sergeant at arms, and you know, the crews that are obviously showing the muscle. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's an accurate picture of the organization.
Mm-hmm.
I think the organization is exactly what it says it is. It's a corporation, and I think as a corporation, they tend to. Not drive Harleys and not look like bikers, mm-hmm. For the most part at the higher levels.
You saw a lot of bad shit with when you throughout your life. That's an understatement, Paul. You know, especially in the motorcycle gang club world. I mean, did the Hells Angels ever do anything good? I mean, did you ever see any good come out of the club, or was it all just drug dealing and human trafficking or any stuff like that?
Well, if you want to call the toy run a good thing, you know, that they give a teddy bear to a mm-hmm. little girl when she's eight, and then when she's 18, that same club is passing around the clubhouse as a toy.
Yeah.
Is there people in there that are deceived into thinking that they're good people, and do they have kids like everybody else? Absolutely. I mean. Mm-hmm. You know, I was a criminal. I thought I loved my children for what I knew of love. So I guess that's what they see themselves as.
Yeah, that's
sometimes.
The perception, yeah.
It's a perception of themselves. I think they're self-deceived, right?
That's a good point. I mean, is it hard when you're in a gang like that, the Hells Angels, to get out? Or can you leave it? Can you give it up? I mean, for the listener out there, what are your thoughts on that? Or have you ever seen it and there's retribution or what?
I've seen a few people leave, in a good way, I guess. If you can say that, I don't know. It's usually mostly because they have an addiction and the club wants to let them go, but they don't want to kill them. I don't know. I don't think there's a good ending to any crime life, but I think you've got pretty much three endings, not good ones. You're going to be in witness protection the rest of your life. You're going to be in prison the rest of your life, or you're going to be dead.
Mm-hmm.
So
that's a good point.
If you don't mind any one of those three endings, then this is the career for you.
tell us about your consulting, because you go out there and you talk a lot. You get in front of people. So what are you doing out there, Paul?
I do a lot of source handling, criminology courses, justice studies, community groups. I try to educate in the community, police services boards once in a while.
Yeah.
I'd like to see more of that, because that's where the money comes from. But, wherever I can educate, I say often I'd like to educate the public and, the ignorant in the public, those that just don't know, and then kick the asses of the apathetic because they live in bubbles.
Yeah. And you go out there and you talk about your experiences and in crime. And is that what you talk about and kind of steer people away or what specifically?
It depends on the audience.
Sure.
I mean, obviously to police officers, I talk about the dangers of a person like me and what it's like to deal with, me as an informant, because, mm-hmm. you know, it's dangerous.
Yeah.
I'm going to screw you every chance I can.
Yeah.
It's an odd relationship of trust and, yet we manipulate each other.
I was going to say, there's a lot of manipulation going back and forth.
On both sides. So, and we have to somehow put parameters around that in order to trust each other with our lives, but yet know that we both can't trust each other. So it's a very odd relationship. It's like a very dysfunctional marriage.
But you survived it. And you came through it?
Yeah. I did okay. And I even like my ex.
That's good.
He was a good handler.
Now, what do you mean by he was a good handler? He kept you, his good communication back and forth or what? Trust to some extent?
Trust. You know what? I guess he's retired now. I can talk about him a little bit more, but he ended up climbing the ranks and became deputy commissioner of the RCMP. But, you know, I think he did that, and that bodes well to his leadership skills.
Mm-hmm.
He had parameters and rules, and he didn't bend them. And mm-hmm. he had a great moral compass. He had good communication skills, knew how to laugh, you know, but he knew that there was rules that I had to stay within. We're, you know, informants, criminals in general, we're like little kids, right? We test our limits, you know, so it's kind of like, you know, if you're a source handler, you have to learn how to be a really good parent to a really rebellious child.
Yeah. And you get, and they can't, and like you talked about the manipulation. I mean, if you, as long as you stand firm, you know, it's like, oh, I'm not getting it, you know, so I'll try this angle. And you got to be smart, obviously. I mean, you're smart, and your handlers were smart, and you just got to stay firm, like you said. Yeah, you're right. It's like a parent.
Yeah, and I think one of the things police officers forget, you know, that I have to remind them is if a guy like me has chosen to be a career criminal, there's lots of people that fall into crime because of different circumstances. But when you talk about organized crime groups, most of them are people made up of, you know, that they've chosen that as a career. Mm-hmm. They're studying the police as much as the police are studying them.
You know, that's a good point.
I kept files on them. Yeah, I mean, we studied them, we followed them, we did surveillance on them, we found as much dirt on them, we tried to corrupt them. And I think police sometimes get complacent and forget that. And some don't even know that. I mean,
that's a
unless you're
point.
In the source handling world, you don't know that.
Yeah, that's a great point, counterintelligence, because we're spending all this time running after people like you. But that's a great point, Paul, that you're doing the same thing to the police.
Absolutely.
Which makes sense. You made a career out of this, and there's many more people out there, and it makes sense that there would be counterintelligence going on.
Absolutely, 100%. That's why I'm always baffled when I see police officers on different places like social media, like on LinkedIn. You'll see lots of people go, police are corrupt here, or so-and-so has been corrupted. And yeah, that's what we do. We spend our days trying to corrupt people, like in every part of life. What criminals do. They try to break rules.
Yeah, but there's criminals out there, and you know, there's criminals out there that, you know, just they don't spend the time doing that. They don't spend
Absolutely.
The time probably, you know, doing some research on police, but it would bode well if they did, because they might be a little bit more, they might have a longer life, you know, and last a little long under the radar.
Well, I think that's why you see the prisons are filled with those types.
Yeah.
The prisons are filled. I remember when I got my 7-year sentence, mm-hmm. and I walked into prison, and I thought, after, you know, reading these books and studying and aspiring to be all these people I read books about. And then I got inside and I'm going, wow, this is what I aspired to be. And I'm looking around thinking, this is horrible. These people are, you know, they're planning their next score. They're not even done finished. They're not even finished the time for their last one. And, you know, most of them are, you know, not career criminals, but they're doing life on the installment plan.
Mm-hmm.
A little bit here and a little bit there for a VCR or whatever, DVD player or whatever they have nowadays.
Yeah. So what was the catalyst in your life, Paul? I mean, was it just kind of getting a little older? What was it?
No, it started off when I, the night, I remember I got arrested in the murder of Sean Simmons. I was in the middle of trying to get an operation, and that's another thing. Informants are always trying to get an operation as an agent, because that's where the bigger money is. So I was trying to get this operation going. Sean ends up getting killed in the midst of that. So I get arrested by a different department that has no idea that I'm an informant. And so then I turn around, and obviously it's going to come out that I was speaking to the RCMP about it.
Mm-hmm.
So I had, you know, and I knew I had all the evidence. I knew they knew nothing.
Sure.
Their story, they had no evidence whatsoever, no clue what took place. They had very little to go on. And so I was laying in my cell that night. They were going to arraign me the next day on some weapons charges. And I was laying in my cell that night, and I thought, you know what, do I want to continue? Is this the time to get out?
Mm-hmm.
Or do I go do the year on remand, beat the charge, and continue on?
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought, you know, this is it. And
yeah.
Then I, you know, I had a little bit of a, the one thing they always allow you in jail is a Bible. So that helped. I mean, I had that, and I did a little bit of reading and studying, and, you know, went down that road for a while.
Yeah. Tell us about your book, Inside a Police Informant's Mind.
That was based on the relationship with the handler that I spoke about.
Mm-hmm.
So the first part of it is motivations and the manipulations of an informant, why people become informants, agents. And the other is what it takes to be a good source handler to be able to lead someone like me.
Mm-hmm. And we're
a little bit of everything.
And it's, I think police officers read this. I mean, you, like we talked about, there's a lot of good information that police officers need to know about informants, right?
I think if you're going to work with a source, if you're going to work with informants, yes. I mean, mm-hmm. obviously there's police officers that will never work with a source in their life. They want to put in their 9-to-5, do their stuff and go home. But those that are going to work with sources, you got to know what we're like. I mean, mm-hmm. you got to know you're going to get those calls at midnight, 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock in the morning when we're lonely and looking for somebody to talk to.
if people want to reach out to you or find your book, how do they do that, Paul?
They can go to my website at paulderry.ca or paulderry.net. Punch in Paul Derry on Google, you'll find me.
Any other books on the horizon or what?
Doing one on the Canadian justice system right now, Through the Eyes of a Criminal. Tentatively called Obscene Reality.
Mm-hmm. And it just kind of talks about the CJ system in Canada.
Yeah, kind of taking it right from the day you get picked up by the police. So from policing right on through to corrections. So it's going to touch on each aspect, going through the court system, some of the problems I've seen. I've testified in, I don't know how many trials now. I've spent so many hours on the stand now that it's mind-boggling.
Mm-hmm.
It touches a lot on the stuff in the court systems itself, mm-hmm. and a lot in corrections.
Now, from your point of view, what you've been through in your life, obviously you have opinions of law enforcement and police officers. What do you think some of the challenges law enforcement today faces? And that's probably many, but from your point of view and what you've been through and your side of the fence.
I think the thing they have, the biggest problem is public perception, mm-hmm. Resources,
mm-hmm.
And those kind of go hand in hand. I mean, the taxpayer pays the police, and if the taxpayers don't realize there is an issue, they are not going to put the money forth to fix the issue.
Sure.
So what happens? I mean, if you have a minority of police officers who do, that do get corrupted, and believe me, they are hard to corrupt. Mm-hmm. as one who's corrupted them, they're hard. It's not an easy thing to corrupt. I've corrupted a lot of people in my life. I've manipulated a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
And most police join for the right reasons. Most police join as a calling. Most police want to make a difference,
mm-hmm.
and they are hard to corrupt because they have good moral compasses. The problem is the media latches on to the few that, don't fit into that group. And so the public perception is that one,
mm-hmm.
Which is bad because that means it's harder to get money for the right things. Mm-hmm. The other thing is we get so caught up in terrorism and, abroad that we, and worrying about, ISIS coming here and not worrying about meth flooding our streets and killing people all around us.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, both, and that's important too. I mean, the terrorism, but there needs to be more of a, what's the what's the priority here? We need to look at our own backyard sometimes.
Yeah, absolutely. If you've got people dropping all around you because we've allowed organized crime to flourish,
mm-hmm.
and that's what we've done. We've allowed it. We would rather take our money and put it towards, the people in their bubbles who, they don't want their car broken into tonight.
Mm-hmm.
So, unfortunately, politics comes into it, and politics dictates where the resources go.
Yeah. And I don't know about in Canada. I'm sure it's the same there. But here in the States, you probably heard, Paul, or know, I mean, the opiate crisis is out of control.
It's insane.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is. It's insane. And it is. It's just killing people up. I talk about the meth because it's already spread and the Hells Angels have the bigger monopoly of that market. But, yeah, the fentanyl and opiates are huge up here right now, too.
Yeah, that's horrible. Well, Paul Derry, sir, I know you're busy. I want to thank you for taking the time to come on the show. We wish you much success in the future. We will have your website and your book linked up. In the show notes. Any parting words of wisdom, sir?
Words of wisdom. Yeah, for criminals, stay out of crime. There's no happy ending. And, you know, for those that are out there fighting, like, keep your head up and know that it's a dangerous job.
Yeah. All righty, sir. You take care.
Thanks, Patrick.
Thanks for listening to CJ Evolution. Be sure to head over to iTunes and rate and review the podcast, and reach out to Patrick on Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter, Anchor, or Snapchat. We'll see you next time on CJ Evolution.